From Luminary Media and Built It Productions, it's Wisdom from the Top. Stories of crisis, failure, turnaround, and triumph from some of the greatest leaders in the world. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, the story of Lou Gerstner and IBM.
This is a company that 2 years before that had shown the biggest profits, I think, ever by any company. And within a period of 3 years, it was losing billions of dollars. The board of directors had decided to break it up into pieces and sell it off. And so when I got there, I had to unlock this huge talent pool that was there and get them energized and focused and working in a different way.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So the legendary CEOs of the 1990s were people like Jack Welch of GE or John Chambers of Cisco, who was on our show last season. But another name that dominated the pantheon of great CEOs at the end of last century was Lou Gerstner of IBM. Not only was he the first IBM CEO to be recruited from outside the company, but when he was asked to take the job in 1993, Lou Gerstner had never really worked for a technology company. And as you'll hear, he arrived to the company in the middle of a huge crisis. Big Blue, as IBM is known, was one of the biggest players in technology in the world. But as the personal computer revolution started to take off in the 1980s, smaller upstarts like Dell and Compaq were leaving IBM in the dust. In addition, Microsoft's Windows system was crushing IBM's OS 2 system. And IBM had a decentralized structure that created a whole series of redundancies and inefficiencies. The day Lou Gerstner arrived at IBM, he famously said, quote, "The last thing IBM needs right now is a vision." And instead, he focused on things like breaking through IBM's internal bureaucracy and making tough decisions. That approach would pay off, because between the time Gerstner arrived to IBM in 1993 and the time he left 9 years later, the company's market cap went from $29 billion to $168 billion. But even though Lou Gerstner is remembered as a legendary CEO, he says he never intended to lead a company. In fact, he never really considered becoming a businessman at all when he was a kid growing up on Long Island.
I grew up in the village of Mineola. Back then, we had some villages in the western part of the island in Nassau County, and for the most part, the rest of the island was farms. No Long Island Expressway, no parkways.
And what did your parents do? What did they do for work?
My father was the traffic manager for the F&M Schaefer Brewing Company. My mother did something about everything. She was a secretary. She sold real estate. She was an officer in a college working on admissions. So whatever she could do, sometimes it was two jobs. My father worked nights. My mother worked days.
And a pretty religious family. Did you guys go to church every weekend? And
we went to church every weekend and on holy days and went to Sunday school. And we had crucifixes and most of the rooms in our house.
Were you a pretty good student?
Yeah, I mean, I worked hard as a student. I don't think much in life comes easy. Maybe there are natural athletes and maybe there are natural geniuses, but no, I'm a firm believer, and I've said to people for many, many years that I believe in that whole prescription that success is 90% perspiration and 10% inspiration. So I did my homework. I worked hard. My parents pushed me, and I enjoyed my work. I enjoyed school, yes.
When you went off to college, you went to Dartmouth, and then you would go on to Harvard to do a business degree. This is in the sort of the early to mid-60s. And at that time, I mean, what did you think you should do with your, I mean, did you have a sense of what you wanted to do with your life or what you should do with your life?
I had absolutely no idea.
Huh.
One of the reasons that I went to Dartmouth is that it offered a bachelor's degree in a BA while I could study science, which was my interest. And while I was in the engineering program at Dartmouth, my favorite subjects were philosophy and French and subjects like that, which sort of steered me away from engineering school. And I'm not quite sure, Guy, that it was terribly insightful, but the alternative was business school at that point.
And so the idea was, well, I'll go there and probably get some kind of job out of that, some kind of stable job that.
Well, I mean, it was probably a little more confident than that. I had worked almost every summer during college. I'd worked for New York Telephone Company. I worked for the Scott Paper Company. I worked for General Motors. All doing summer jobs and got a glimpse into the business world. So I don't think I fell into business, but I don't think I was propelled from my youth to be a CEO, no.
So in your mind, I mean, the idea of becoming a corporate executive, this was not a part of the plan. There was no vision in your mind when you were a younger man that this is what you would do.
Absolutely not. I never met a CEO until I was pretty much out of business school.
So when you finished business school, I mean, today a lot of people who attend business school, particularly Harvard Business School, have dreams of becoming entrepreneurs, as you know, right? This is a really popular area of study, even though a lot of them go on into finance and consulting. There is more of a sort of an entrepreneurial kind of push. When you graduated in 1965, was that the case or
zero?
Zero.
There was none. I mean, there might have been a couple of people who thought about it, but I can't remember a classmate of mine. Back when I graduated, the big avenues of attention for MBAs, at least at Harvard, were consulting and consumer products goods. So being a product manager at Colgate or Procter & Gamble, in fact, my choice came down to Procter & Gamble and McKinsey, the consulting firm, as to my first job, my first full-time job. And quite frankly, one of the reasons I chose to go to McKinsey is I figured it would be an extension of my education and that I would learn a lot in a hurry. And McKinsey had a great reputation at that time, as it does now. And I found it extremely helpful in developing skills.
And what were the kinds of projects that they had you work on?
Well, I'll never forget the first project I was asked to work on was a compensation study for an oil company. And I said to the senior partner, well, I don't know anything about executive compensation. I don't know anything about oil industry. He said, don't worry, you're just going to do the charts. And so I did the grunt work of analysis, and I learned a lot about what it means to take apart a business problem, how to look at the economics of a company, how to understand its competitive analysis. McKinsey was maniacal on making sure that before you made any judgments, you did all of your homework on how the company worked, what was its economics, what was its competitive profile, what were the strategic threats, and only then did you open your mouth with an opinion. And so that was a very important grounding for me in terms of how I think about management.
It, it sounds like from what I've read, I mean, you obviously were committed and smart and worked hard, but you were like kind of like a rising star there, right? I mean, I think by your late 20s, you became a director at McKinsey.
Yes, I enjoyed McKinsey. I really liked it. I became a senior partner. I was on the senior executive committee, and I just decided over the course of the last few years that I was getting less enthusiastic about being the person who brings in the presentation and tries to convince the person at the end of the table to do something. And I said, you know, I really want to be that person at the end of the table. When I decided to leave, you know, McKinsey was very nice about it. They, you know, they wanted me to stay. They told me I had a very, very senior future there, but I left, as do a lot of people at McKinsey, and they're very gracious about that.
This is sort of, we're now in the late 70s, and you get, were you approached by American Express, or had you done work with them before?
Yes, I had done many years of work with American Express. By the way, I had been offered jobs by other clients that I worked for and decided I didn't want those jobs. And
right.
I had been approached by American Express earlier, and I said, no, I don't really want to do that. And then there was a retirement of a very senior person at American Express. And the then president said to me, listen, I want you to come and run what was then the travel-related services company.
Hmm.
And at 30 or 31 years old, all of a sudden, I'm running a company with 35,000 employees and
wow,
multiple hundreds of millions of dollars. And it was I just decided I was going to go do it because I loved the company and I knew about it.
So you were pretty much from the beginning put in a not just a leadership position, but a pretty senior leadership position.
Yes, and that took some adjusting.
Yeah,
probably the biggest adjustment was that. One day, I again, with my McKinsey training, it didn't take me long to figure out that the second most important expense in American Express was credit losses. That's normal in a financial institution. So I looked up in the book who was in charge of credit losses and called this person up to my office and said, now give me a tutorial. And we spent a couple hours on that. It was great. And the next day, I walk in and my assistant said, my God, what have you done? This place is really rocking. I said, well, what's the problem? And she said, well, you met with somebody and there are three levels of management between you and that person. And every one of them is upset that they were not in the meeting. So, you know, at McKinsey, we didn't have any hierarchy. We just, whoever had the smartest comment to make and the best facts, they spoke. And I had to get used to the idea of hierarchy. And it's been an issue I've dealt with throughout my career about meetings and who goes to meetings and why we have meetings and why we should never have meetings. And so that was one of the things that I had to get used to when I went there. By the way, the other thing I had to get used to was how public you are inside a company of that size. One day I remember my boss calling me into his office and he said, you know, Lou, you got to start smiling on elevators. And I said, Jim, you got kidding me. I mean, I'm busting my butt here trying to fix this business and get it growing again and working hard. What do you mean? He said, well, have you noticed that when you get on the elevator in the morning, no one else gets in? They're looking at their new shining boss and they're all wondering who he is and you're not smiling, so start smiling on elevators, Lou. It was another lesson about being sensitive to the way employees look at your behavior as well as what you say and do.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you're thinking, look, you know, I'm working really hard and this is how I should be evaluated, presumably. But I mean, he had a point, right? I mean, that may have seemed trivial, but it was an important point.
Oh, it was a very important point, and I've carried it with me ever since in terms of how you think about your employees' expectations of the company and you. They're not the same as the leader.
Mm.
they come to work doing their jobs. They've got families. They've got fears. They've got health issues in their family there. And they want to feel good about their leader. That was something I had to work on, having been a strong analytical person at McKinsey. And, you know, there's no successful company without a successful culture. And culture is all about how people feel about commitment to the organization. Is the organization committed to them? Does the organization respect them? Does the organization treat them as individuals and with who owe an understanding of what's going on? And so it was a awakening to me about how important it is for a company to have a culture where people feel, on the one hand, safe, but on the other hand, happy to take risk. And taking risk depends on you feeling comfortable with your leaders. And so, yeah, that was the start of my almost preoccupation with the importance of culture in large organizations.
So you are at Amex, and this is a time when, I mean, American Express was not quite the sort of the powerhouse that it is today. I think, I mean, I'm assuming that when you, in the early days of your time at American Express, you know, this is a time where you literally couldn't use the card in a lot of places. Like, a lot of huge retailers didn't even accept it, right?
Yeah, so there were two things that really I had to address in American Express. And the most important was that American Express owned what I think might have been the greatest business ever created in the world. It was called Traveler's Checks. And you gave people a whole bunch of money because you wanted to have a good vacation. And so you overbought traveler's checks way in advance of the vacation. Then you went on vacation. You came home with a third or half of them left, and you put them in a drawer. And all that time, American Express had your money. It was a float business way before Berkshire Hathaway's float business. And the American Express card was going to threaten that business. And so when I arrived, I had a senior management that wanted to protect traveler's checks and not let the card grow very fast. And so the companies that hang on to their most profitable base business at the time of change are going to die.
They're doomed, yeah.
And so what I had to do, most of anything, is to convince the leadership team there that the card was the future, and if we didn't build it, someone else was going to build it, and whomever built it was going to destroy the traveler's check business. So that was my hardest job. We then had to take the card around the world. There were eight countries that had the card, eight currencies that had the card. When I got there were 31 currency cards when I left. And of course, we had to get far more aggressive about getting acceptance of the card in more places around the world, which meant reducing our prices.
So, I mean, this is almost impossible to imagine today, but in 1978, traveler's checks were still hugely profitable for American Express and would be for another decade or so, but clearly this was not going to be a product on which to throw all of your chips in, right? I mean, the traveler's checks business was, you could see where it was eventually going to go. But there was resistance inside the company to actually what I guess that they sort of saw the card as an internal competitor.
Of course, but don't you think that at Kodak, digital photography was viewed as a competitor
by
the guys who made the little yellow boxes?
Right.
And so this is a practice or a behavior that I've termed the success syndrome, where there's a business that is enormously successful, has been successful for multiple decades, and then a threat comes along, and it is very, very difficult for that company to move away and cannibalize its existing product and build up what is effectively an internal competitor. People say to me, well, gee, didn't Kodak, did they not see digital photography? Of course they saw it. They invented it.
Yeah.
And didn't AT&T see mobile or cellular communication? Yeah, they invented it at Bell Labs. But they simply couldn't drive the organization away from its enormously successful base in a different direction. And that's really what happened at American Express. That's what we had to do. We had to say, the future is in cards. It's not in paper-based checks. And how you do it is you simply have to continually create a sense of urgency. You have to create a sense of strategic loss. You have to create a sense that over time, we're going to die if we don't do this. And then you have to develop a pathway, an execution plan that says, okay, here's the best way to hang on to the old business while we build up the new business. But these are the principles that we will not violate. We will not hold back the new business where it needs critical resources. Guy, this is the problem of so many companies today. As you think about the revolution in information technology, think about the retailers.
Right.
You know, moving off of the base business of running stores was awful hard. The other thing we did while I was there is we segmented the market and introduced, you know, a gold card and then a platinum card. And as I said, we went from 8 currencies to 31 currencies and then expanded the number of stores or outlets that respected or took the card. And those three dimensions got the card business growing to the point where it very quickly overtook the revenue and profits of the traveler's check business. And the fact that we were able to grow it very quickly ameliorated a bit the decline in traveler's checks, and we never had to have a down year.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm curious, when you were at American Express, what was your sense of where you would go there? I mean, did you at a certain point, you must have thought, you know, I think I want to lead this company. I want to become the CEO of this place.
Well, I certainly felt that way. And in fact, I was, for the most part, told that was going to happen at some point.
Yeah.
And then it didn't. And so then when the opportunity to go to RJR Nabisco came along, I decided to take it.
So how I know that at the time when you went to RJR Nabisco, there was a lot of, I mean, certainly in A lot of Wall Street analysts were saying, well, how, you know, what does Lou Gerstner know about food and tobacco? When you got there, what did you sort of face? What was the landscape that you were now kind of overseeing?
Well, Guy, there's a very famous book written about this called Barbarians at the Gate.
Mm-hmm.
And Archer & Nabisco was the eighth most admired company in the world, according to, I think, Business Week at that point. And I was enamored with the idea of now running a very large and successful company.
Yeah.
But what happened is that financial markets were going through very difficult times, so that I had a piece of debt, Guy, that carried a 21% interest rate.
Wow.
I had another one which was 19.5, and it was so-called PIK paper, which means you didn't pay interest, you just paid more debt. And it kept getting reset every year. It kept going up and up and up. So what happened at Archer & Nabisco is I spent most of my time selling assets to pay off the debt that had been created for the LBO.
You were selling off companies, businesses that were owned by...
Yes. And of course, when you are up against the wall and your balance sheet is about to explode and you're about to lose control of a company, you have to sell the best asset, not the worst assets. And you have to take the first price and not the last price. And so we wound up selling some very, very successful companies that had been put together. I mean, Archer & Nabisco had been assembled over the last decade from a whole bunch of individual companies. And so the food company included, you know, Lifesavers, as well as Oreos, as well as other snack, Planters peanuts.
Right.
And so we sold off everything we could to pay down the debt.
And some of those products, like I think Oreos, for example, are owned by Mondelez today, a completely different company.
Right.
So you were there, I think, for 4 years, and I guess while you were at RJR Nabisco, IBM had come knocking a few times, interested in sort of gauge, you know, measuring your interest in whether you would come there or not, and you would sort of turn them down a couple of times before you agreed to go there.
Yes, I left to go to IBM on April 1st, 1993, appropriately April Fool's Day. And I think that the IBM search started at prior September. They did approach me, and they approached a whole lot of people, as it's well documented. And I said immediately, I said, no, I can't run a technology company. I mean, I know how to use technology, but I certainly can't run a technology company. So, no, thank you. They came back a few weeks later and said, come on, keep your hat in the ring. And I said, I don't have a hat in this ring. And they were, I think, running out of candidates.
Wow.
I don't think anybody wanted that job. And then eventually they convinced me that it was a leadership challenge, not a technology challenge. And then I got a little more interested in it, and I went through a series of processes to go look at some of the numbers. And then one day I took a walk on the beach and I said, should I do this or should I not do this?
Hmm.
And I came home and I said to my wife and children, well, I'm going to take it.
I mean, this was I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the year that you joined, IBM posted an $8 billion loss. The shares of IBM were down to like $12, right? I mean, the company was just hemorrhaging money. It was in really bad shape. Presumably, it had to do with the sort of the PC clones, right? I mean, that IBM really hadn't positioned itself to compete in that market in a way that it should have.
That's correct. And the loss, I believe, that they announced that spring for the prior year was the largest loss that ever recorded up until that point by an American corporation. And yes, let's go back to our success syndrome that we talked about with traveler's checks. IBM had a remarkable business built around mainframes, which had really created information technology for the most part in large institutions around the world. And for reasons that we don't have time to go in this discussion, people decided they wanted more distributed computing. Individuals in a corporation wanted access to a terminal where they could do some computing on their own as opposed to running to the IT guy and begging for time. And so the customer started to want distributed computing, as it's called. And IBM basically knew that and started really the creation of the PC industry, but then it didn't get behind it. Again, it was so wedded to the mainframe that it really didn't get fully behind in any way a distributed environment for computing. This is a company that 2 years before that had shown the biggest profits, I think, ever by any company.
Wow.
It was always ranked year after year as the number one company in the world. And within a period of 3 years, it was losing billions of dollars. And as I was arriving, the board of directors had decided to break it up into pieces and sell it off.
Right.
And the company was frozen. People couldn't believe what had happened. They had grown up, and IBMers for the most part were lifers. They had grown up believing they were part of this extraordinary, and they were correct, they were part of an extraordinary successful company. But things changed, the world changed, and they didn't change. And so when I got there, I had to unlock this huge talent pool that was there and get them energized and focused and working in a different way.
But when you were recruited to go to IBM and your initial response was, I'm not a technology person, this is not my area of expertise, and someone said, look, the problem at IBM is a leadership problem. What was the leadership problem? What were the things that you actually had to change?
Well, the first thing that I had to change was repositioning the mainframe, which meant that we had to drastically cut its prices because it was getting attacked by two Japanese companies that had basically cloned the IBM system. And so we had to cut prices by almost 50% in a period of a few months, which again was something that was fought bitterly inside the company, because that's where, if there were any profits, that's where they were coming from. So now the losses were going to be worse. The second thing I had to do is I had to decide whether we were going to keep the company together or to continue to break it up into pieces. And I made the decision as a former customer of IBM that we were going to keep it together, that there was a unique value that IBM brought to the industry. And that was its ability to deliver solutions that encompassed hardware, software, and services. So that was the second thing we had to do. And then thirdly, we just had to unlock the talent and get people working differently than worked before.
But how, I mean, I would think that the third would in some ways be the most challenging, because how do you do that? How do you unlock that?
Well, you're right. The first two decisions were relatively easy for me. The third one of how do you get the company working together is took a whole series of steps. Communication. I mean, I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours talking to people all over the world in IBM and saying to them, look, there's nothing wrong with IBM. The problem is that we're just not paying attention to customers. We have the technology. We have the resources. Now let's go out and get reconnected with our customers and listen to them and deliver what they want. So I got the company focused externally on winning again and not frozen and thinking about internal things. Then we had the guy, we had to go and change every single process in the company. And I'm telling you, that was a five-year challenge. One of my associates at the time described process transformation as setting your hair on fire and putting it out with a hammer.
Yeah.
We had to, for example, change the organization, which almost destroyed me. IBM was a train wreck of decentralization. My good friends at McKinsey, when I was there, you know, made tons of money going around the world and convincing people that decentralization was the way to run global companies. And in many respects, at the time, it was. But by the time you got to IBM in 1993, it was astonishingly over-decentralized. I mean, we had many IBMs in almost every country in the world. I remember when I got there asking, well, how are we doing with the 1-800-IBM marketing activity? And I was told, oh, no, corporate doesn't own the 1-800-IBM number. It's owned by the Alabama branch, and they won't give it to us. We had data centers all over the world. We had everybody who wanted an advertising agency hired their local advertising agency. So this train wreck of decentralization had created massive amounts of cost in each organization, and it had created a rigor mortis in terms of people working together. So I had to change the organization. I had to change the compensation system. I had to change the measurement system and what we measured and what we looked at. Those are all processes that we had to go through to get people focused on a new strategy, the strategy that I had outlined of being the company that delivers solutions. And that's why I had to drive a culture that valued teamwork above anything else.
But how did you do that when you came in as an outsider? I mean, presumably you had to bring in a new team. You had to get rid of some people. But those aren't enough. I mean, you still need buy-in. I mean, there's still hundreds of thousands of employees. You have to believe in that, right?
So the best thing that happened to me at IBM was, and I knew it was there, and it was probably the reason I eventually decided to go, was I knew it was full of talented people. I mean, I had competed with IBM over the years when I was at other companies trying to hire people, and they almost always won. And so my job was to convince them that we needed to do something different. We really, and it wasn't too hard given the situation we were in. I didn't bring in many outsiders, Guy. I mean, there was no HR head when I got there, and there was no finance head when I got there. So I had to bring in people from the outside. But I had to make some choices among the people who were in the senior group. IBM had this general view, which again, I think is in successful organizations, that as you grow up in an organization, as you become a leader, your job is to preside. You preside.
Yeah.
And I don't believe that. I believe as you move up in an organization, you dig in and you stay close to the facts, you stay close to the marketplace, you stay close to customers, and you're as knowledgeable as the people who work in your department, if not more. We had something I called Operation Bear Hug, where I said to the top 50 to 100 people in the company, over the next 2 months, you're going to go out and visit 5 customers and tell them that we care about them and listen to them and find out what we can do for them. Everybody. The lawyer said to me, well, I can't do that. I said, yes, you are going to do that. They had a communication, said, well, I can't do that. I said, yes, you are. And I said, I want you to send me a 4-page letter or memo about each of your visits, and I'm going to read every one of them. You know, changing a culture is about changing processes. You don't manage a culture directly. You can't just jump on culture and say change. You have to change what people do and what they value and what you reward. in a company. And so that's why this process change was so important, because we could not have become an integrated company. We could not have become hardware, software, and services without integrating inside the company and changing the way we paid people.
How were you able to hold people accountable? I mean, there are huge challenges. There are multiple challenges. There are dozens of potential solutions, and then other initiatives, and then other problems that are coming to you. So, how were you able to sort of figure out how to compartmentalize and focus on very specific things? Because it's practically impossible for a single human to juggle 50 different things at the same time, or even 10 different things at the same time.
I want you to know, Guy, that I went home every weekend with four briefcases. I rarely got home at night before 8 or 9 o'clock at night. Was left for the office at 6:30 or 7 in the morning. Traveled all over the world, and probably 2 months after I was at IBM, I said to my wife, "I made a mistake.
Wow,
I can't do it." I felt like I was walking in quicksand.
Overwhelming.
I'd take one step forward and I'd two steps down. But eventually, there were things that we could do quickly to stabilize the company. So we quickly found some ways to cut losses. When I got to IBM, we had four businesses that were losing $1 billion each.
Wow.
And I said to myself, "Well, I don't know, Lou. This is easy, Lou. All you got to do is get two of those to zero, and you've made $2 billion." Well, it wasn't so easy, but we did find ways to very rapidly improve the stability of the company, the financial stability, and then I was able to say to the organization, "Now we are stable financially, now we're going to go grow." And because we were able to do that, we actually turned a profit, I think, in the fifth or sixth quarter after I was there. That gave me some time to sort out the 50 things.
When did you start to see a turnaround? When did you start to sort of see the light? I mean, because when you got there, it was a crisis, right? Billions of dollars being lost. And how long did it take before you started to see?
I told you earlier that we turned a profit in about the fifth or sixth quarter, and I really was unhappy about that. I didn't want that, because I knew that was going to lead a whole bunch of IBMers to say, "Oh, good, now we can go back to the way we were before."
right.
And I was still trying to drive this sense of urgency, this sense of crisis, which is absolutely tantamount to any organization to really transform itself. I would say it was about 3 years in, maybe four, when we had stabilized the company, and then we came up with the e-business campaign. And that put IBM in a leadership position in the industry. We now were leading something, because the industry went from mainframe to PC to e-business or network business. And we were in front of that. And it gave the company a sense that we were not only fighting a defensive game, but we were now out in front. And that's when I felt that the wind had turned from directly in our face to our back. And I just got to tell you, Guy, that there is a dramatic difference. You can feel it in an organization when the wind moves from in your face to in your back. And that's occurred about 3 years in. And then I knew we were on our way.
When you think about your career and what you ended up doing, I mean, do you think that you, in some ways, were born with leadership skills, or do you think that you learned how to become a leader?
Well, that's a question I get regularly when I teach at these leadership forums. Guy, I think that 99% of management is acquired, and management is a very large percentage of leadership. There's maybe 10 or 20% of leadership that is emotional, it's intuitive, it's just attitude. I mean, great leaders imbue organization with an emotional commitment. They create passion. They create a sense of belonging, a sense of achievement, a sense of challenge. And you have to learn how to communicate. You have to learn how to manage your time. You have to learn how to do performance appraisals. You have to learn about how to do good competitive analysis. And those are skills that I think you have to work on in a lifetime.
As you know, Lou, there is a lot of conversation about the responsibility of corporations towards the public and towards their workers. And, you know, you've been really outspoken about it, and you've said that corporations have a responsibility beyond just making money.
That's correct. And somehow a whole bunch of people seem to have discovered that corporations should have a responsibility beyond their shareholders. And, you know, I find this a somewhat amusing discussion because I don't know why we haven't learned or recognized that there is no successful corporation that doesn't worry about its employees, doesn't worry about the communities in which it works. I mean, you can't have a successful company in an unsuccessful community. Mm. You can't expect to have good workers, good staff members, if you don't have an education system in the country producing people who can learn and know something and can communicate and can live in a 20th century world. So to think that corporations can simply only worry about their shareholders is a myopic view mm-hmm. that I've never felt had any value. And here's my point. I don't view this as some additional challenge, additional responsibility imposed on a corporation. I view this as an absolute necessary and important part of being a corporation, of being successful.
That's the former CEO of IBM, Lou Gerstner. Lou is now retired and spends much of his time working with his foundation. And he's probably not going to be rushing back to head another company anytime soon. When asked what he misses about being a CEO, he answered, quote, "Not that much." Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. The music for this episode was composed and performed by Drop Electric. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Wisdom from the Top from Luminary Media and Built It Productions.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Transitioning to a decarbonized economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organization and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts, or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.